Greetings, everyone. I'm Rafael Tamayo, manager of the Oak Cliff Cultural Center, a division of the City of Dallas Office of Arts and Culture, and you are listening to OC3 Frequencies, a podcast presented by us. We're really excited today. We have a wonderful artist here to talk, but before we get into the conversation, I'm going to let our staff introduce themselves.
Hey, everyone. It's Iris Bechtel, Gallery Programs Coordinator here.
Hey, I'm Andrea Tostin, Cultural Programs Coordinator.
Yes, and before we jump in, I want to say I'm going to work really hard to try to get this episode out. Of course, this doesn't mean anything to the listeners, but I'm making a point right now before we start the conversation, just because before our guest got here, we were all kind of talking about what our initial impressions were of your exhibit, of your work, and it sort of opened the door to a lot of other conversations. So I think today is going to be really cool, but for the OC3 team, for our artist guest, I'm going to try to get this out as soon as possible because I'm looking forward to how cool of a conversation this is going to be. But without further ado, I'll let Iris take it away.
Thanks, Rafa. Well, on this episode today, we have artist Saxon Martinez. Saxon has a Master of Fine Arts from the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas, and a Bachelor of Fine Arts from Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. His work has been included in exhibitions in Texas, Colorado, and most recently in California at Sequoia University. He is a recipient of the Greater Denton Arts Council microgrant and was awarded a Juror Choice Award for his work in the 500X Gallery Expo 2022 exhibition. His work has been featured in Glass Tire's Top 5 and in Under the Bridge magazine. He is a native of Oak Cliff and currently lives and works in Fort Collins, Colorado, teaching. Saxon, welcome to OC3 Frequencies and to Oak Cliff Cultural Center. Your exhibit, Memoirs, opens tomorrow, Saturday, January 20th. Can you tell us a little bit about this exhibition to get us started?
So this exhibition came from, one, knowing that I'd be able to come back here and pay homage to my time in Oak Cliff, which was pretty much up until my 20s. And growing up here and growing up really close to my family, because everyone is pretty much around from Dallas, thinking about all that combined, I wanted to do something that brought me back home. And one of those things is talking about my own story, like the memoirs of my life, but also the pictorial plane of photographs and memories. And so with that, I wanted to create more of an abstract idea of like those two combined. Mm-hmm. And so from there, I wanted to incorporate the motif of piñatas, and my current practice and now this 2D work, this entire series is derived from that.
Great. Thank you for that. Can you talk a little bit more about the pictorial and specifically, you know, when you installed, well, actually, I think your dad did most of the install.
Yes,
for
yes.
You.
It was a performance piece, yes. Only witnessed by a handful here.
And it was a wonderful performance. And I feel like it was done with a lot of love, too. So can you take us to that area of the concept of the work?
I can. Again, a lot of the work does come from like the pictorial plane. And what I mean by that specifically is the pictorial plane in that rectangular square form that my earliest education comes from my father. It's not photographs necessarily, but the combination of photographs my dad would put together. He would grab different pieces of wood and pieces of glass he had from different sites, and he would just grab whatever photos he had at the time and just throw them up on the wall. And so I, after going to college and understanding, like, it's a salon style kind of arrangement. And growing up, when I was little, you're looking up at these photos and they're just everywhere. They're different sizes, different shapes. There is no like consistent, all right, this is from the 90s to 2000s. There's nothing like that. And when all the work was created, I wanted to take that experience. And not only did I want to take it, but I don't think my dad and I talked about it, but I wanted him to really install the work with as little guidance as possible, because mm-hmm. that's what he did. And that's what's still up in our living room to this day. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of a little bit of why we did it in that way. Mm-hmm. And, how it came to be. Yeah.
Wow. I also, listening to y'all talk and thinking about conversations I overheard you having with Iris the other day during the installation, can you talk a little bit about your use of materials and also the affordability of the pieces and why that's important to you, the accessibility of your work?
To go off the last question, accessibility is, for me, the reality of the work itself is it's my livelihood in one sense. It's the things that I make. So, you know, I can't necessarily give it out for free as much as I would love to. But at the end of the day, what I want to do is for individuals who may enjoy it visually in the community to be able to take something out into the world and have it in their own homes. And that's really the core concept of what I do. My work in general is down to the numbers sense and, you know, everything that comes in between. And so after making the work from the smallest piece I could possibly make to the largest piece I could possibly make, I do breakdown of time, hours, material costs, and then, you know, where can I be okay with just making sure the work gets to a new home or living in a place. And that's kind of like, I want it to exist in the world, and I want those who can just enjoy it for the aesthetics of it that can have it. For those individuals who have a deeper understanding or a conversation about it because of whatever reasons, education, upbringing, their relationship to me, then they can enjoy it in their own way. But the most important thing is that the value of the work is not inherently monetary. It's the connection that the individual feels about it. So that's mm-hmm. kind of where that came from. I'm sorry. I think there was like a two-parter, and so that was the last part.
Well, yes, I'm kind of bad about that.
No, you're good.
I was asking about also your use of materials.
Yeah, so use of materials, this is a slight change in most of the work. So starting from my undergrad program, piñatas in general were my last semester of work. And then in my master's program, that's where it really kind of came to be. And so when I started making piñatas, I did the core idea of piñatas, which were, let me rephrase that. There are different styles of creating piñatas, and piñatas exist in a multitude of ways. Mm-hmm. This particular style just consists of paper and cardboard, not necessarily traditional piñatas. And I worked in 3D. And then from there, those piñatas, the three-dimensional piñatas, use tissue paper, you know, anything you can get at Target or Walmart or whatever the mm-hmm. case is. And with that comes a lot of, a lot of hazards. Paper, Texas, humidity, mm-hmm. not really the best combination. So I wanted the work to make sure it could be a little bit more durable, but also reflect the color that I've experienced here and a lot of other places in Texas. And so the change of ideas of moving from like regular tissue paper, and the material now is mulberry paper. It's similar to tissue paper in the visual aspects of it, but it still kind of holds up like paper. The great thing I love about it is the mulberry paper will take on a lot of color. And that was like really important to me. It needed to be able to like hold those abilities of color. And part of growing up in Oak Cliff specifically, the walking around neighborhoods, seeing tagging and graffiti, yes, mm-hmm. some of those things, you know, aren't great, but sometimes there are people out there creating what they feel is like their own style, mm-hmm. and it's a spray paint, and it has its own history, and it has its own political sense, and it has its own community within it. And so instead of like dyeing paper and using just solid colors, I wanted more control over that. But I also wanted a level of abstraction that could be folded in without obstructing, like, is that a line or a circle, or is that what it looks like in the moment? So gradation and color and that control, this level of control, is really important to me. And so moving with that, I wanted to make something that didn't look like it was mass produced, that had intentionality, but also familiarity. And so that's what led me to those materials and these choices of color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
I do want to take like a middle kind of segue in here. Did y'all find the upside down one yet?
Oh, no.
Okay, okay. All right.
I was thinking about that today as I was walking through. And
I know.
But I think, you know, another thing about this exhibition is that there's a lot of work. Yeah. I mean, you think you said like 90 pieces. I didn't count them, but
yeah, I think I got got up to 90.
Yeah, we'll count them from the list. But yeah, there's a lot of work, and when I was doing the lighting and kind of walking through, and of course picking what pieces I wanted. Sorry, y'all, I got a preview. I think there's something about this show that it's part of it is like how it's installed, right? That's so surprising. You know, they're all at kind of differing heights. Some are low, some are high, some are, you know, just like quirkily, you know, installed at the very edge of a wall. And of course, that was like a lot of your dad, which was really great. And I saw him installing and it was just like very intuitive. It felt very natural for him to be doing it. He didn't, you know, stand back and look and ascertain what it looked like. He just kept, you know, here we go, just doing this. And, but I think too, there's a thread connecting all of the work. Obviously there's the material connecting the work. But each one is so different and has, like a little surprise wrapped in it that you can't really go through the show and kind of take it all in. You have to kind of see it. I feel like you have to kind of look at it multiple times. And I think that's also why I haven't seen, because I went through and looked at each one. And I think that's why too, I didn't notice the upside down one yet. So I'll have to go back through and find it again. And y'all, when y'all come and see the show, that's your little thing. You have to look for the, what is it? The Easter egg in the show. But yeah, I think there's a lot of surprise in them. I especially, you know, I'm really drawn to the ones that it seems like you're really thinking about the gradations in the paper and how those work to kind of lead your eye and compositionally. But also I was looking back, and especially when I'm looking at the thumbnail sheet here, some of the ones, and you talked about like the graffiti that you see around the neighborhoods here in Oak Cliff and all over Dallas. But some of these, I think, you know, especially the ones with the graffiti, you have to kind of stand back and look at them. Because if you're standing too close, you don't get that. It's a different experience, right? Because you're seeing like just a part of that line versus backing up and seeing it as a whole. And it's different. I mean, I noticed it more when I was looking at the thumbnail sheet and I thought, oh, I need to go back and look at these. Because I think we get that a lot too. Like we're taught to kind of do like a close looking when we're looking at art. And instead of like, you know, and some of these I think require you to, even though some of them are very small and you do have to get close, some of these I feel like you do have to kind of stand back and take it in a different way. And so there's this sort of like, you're really moving your body through the space that the work is installed in versus like just kind of staying in the same spatial distance from the wall as you would normally if you go into, you know, a more traditionally laid out exhibition where everything's at the same height and they're all similar size and, you know, so I find it's just a really beautiful, vibrant exhibition. And I think, you know, in thinking about it being both individual works and an installation as a whole, I think is really powerful. Because when I think about installation, it's about changing space, right? It's about altering space. It's so much about space, you know, and then you've got, you know, individual works, which are about like what's happening within that frame. And I think this is both. Because when I walk in the gallery, I see an installation, you know, and y'all might need to look up what an art installation is. have a little fun on the internet. But installation is about space. And I think, you know, this work has that. So it's like both individual works. Sorry if I'm repeating myself. And I'm just really excited about this because you've accomplished something I think really special in this exhibition. And as excited as I was to have 3D work, I'm like even more excited that this is what you brought to the Oak Cliff Cultural Center to share with this community.
I'm beyond thrilled to be here. This is not because I'm on the podcast, but this is mostly because I grew up in Oak Cliff. Like in grad school or undergrad, you're thought to like, you know, what is your 5-10 year plan? Like, what is it? And this has been a pursuit of mine for the last 6 years to come back here. So I'm very excited to be back and to be bringing this work here.
Yeah. Well, and piggybacking off of Iris bringing up your father installing the work and thinking back to what you said earlier, that your father is one of your first educators, I read a little bit about the fact that your high school wasn't accredited and that you had to earn your GED. So your education at the master level is hard won. And to keep on doing a run-on sentence here, you also talked about, a little bit before we got started, we're talking about being a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I know that you enjoy teaching. For a lot of artists, it's hard to find that balance between teaching and being an active artist. How do you find that balance? And the fact that your education was so hard won, does that have anything to do with it?
Well, just as a disclaimer, my parents had a lot to do with that, and not in a negative way. My mom did graduate high school. My dad didn't get even to middle school. And when I went to the school that we were at, I will say my parents are like, I don't want you to go here, and you know, I think we should go somewhere else. I'm like, oh, my friends are here. Let's stay here. And they, you know, they listened to me and we went there, and it had a lot of influence on a lot of parts of my life. So I definitely didn't even get past high school. I don't have a high school education at all. So getting the GED and all those other things. And then it took me 10 years to get my associate's degree. Right after I got my GED. And education was something that is this concept of importance, and I understand, especially from my parents who are Mexican, who their parents didn't have that, and that wasn't a thing. It was just this idea that you need an education to be successful down the road, and because of my life and everything that happened, education kind of worked its way in there, and my mom was always a component of making sure that I needed to do everything I needed to do in order to be successful in school. And my dad was like, I'll just pick you up and drop you off. I'm going to make sure I get that much for you and everything. And so I look at my educational journey starting at my GED into the master's program in the last like 20 years. And when I step into the classroom, to some degree, it doesn't matter, you know, where people come from or how they identify themselves. It's like I've been in that seat where you're sitting around a group of people and the instructor is talking to people. And this is not a negative comment on any instructor that is teaching currently or has taught, but it's like, you know, when you come here, these are your expectations. You all know this. And being one of the few in class, like, I have no idea what you mean. Mm. What is FAFSA? What are instructor? I thought you were a teacher. And then getting that conversation, all those other things. And so I love teaching because I've been in that seat very recently where it's like, I don't know what any of this is. And, you know, you are my first stop on my educational journey. It's like, great. Like, we can work on this together. I literally just graduated with my master's degree a couple months ago. So all that stuff is really fresh. And coupled with the ability to like my mentality of if I can help at least one student get what they want out of their education and pursue those dreams, and that's great. Coupled with the fact, I keep saying that word, group with the fact that the students coming in, you know, 17 now, 18, 19, 20, I love that question. Like, why are we doing this like that? Like, do we, why? And I'm like, that's a good question. Let's really think about that together. Let's really examine that. I need to examine my ideals and my preconceptions on why, and I want to introduce you to new concepts. So it continuously pushes me to really think about, like, pushing against even the university that taught me these things. It's like, okay, like, how can we come to an agreement on these questions and ideas? Or can we just have a productive conversation? We can learn discourse in this moment together and expand the art practice and the contemporary nature of what art really is or what it should be. I'm using air quotes, sorry. What it should be, right? Yeah. We can have this conversation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I also share with you this similarity. I actually graduated from Texas A&M with a degree in biomedical science. And I saw also that you were thinking about pursuing biomedical science.
Yeah.
Just talk a little bit about that.
So specifically in that, I was interning is a very loose word. I have a background in the military, and during that exiting time, I was like, okay, how can I support myself and the future? And anyone who's with me at the time was like, doctors, right? That's a good idea. I can do something close to that. And I really care about taking care of my teeth. So dentistry, biomedical science, it kind of just fell into there. And that's what I ended up pursuing. I interned at a hospital for a couple months, shadowing people. And then I went to Colorado State and was doing biomedical science for up to a year while taking a single art class with my good friend slash boss, Mark Dineen. And in that time, I was like, you know what? I've been doing what everyone's told me I need to be doing for the last 10 plus years in my past career. I miss this. I really miss my art practice because, I used to go to the community colleges here in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And for almost 3 years, my concentration was ceramics. And then that vastly changed. And sitting there in that classroom, like, I remember sitting with my friend at the time, instructor Mark Dineen, and he was like, if you want to take a picture of the mountains, go take a picture of the mountains, go hike, come into the classroom, show me what you want to do, and then pursue that thing. Because if you don't have anything you really want to add to the conversation, then that's fine. That's great. Let's figure out what you really want to pursue so you can find that passion. Because you, if you want to be in this world, if you want to be in the art practice, you got to have more than just like, I'm gonna do the thing that looks like a thing to make that exact thing. And that's not saying anything to hyperrealism or any of those kind of pursuits. Right. It was just in that classroom environment, you got to have your own stake in the game or mm-hmm. you're never going to be part of the game.
That's a lot. So is that where it clicked for you? Because it seems, it sounds like you have a lot of different types of experiences that I know people have only had the bravery to commit to kind of one of those things. And, you know, I have friends and family, and I'm not saying that they're defined by their time in the military, right? But that was the one thing where that's their thing, right? They did it, they committed, they do it, they're great at it, awesome. You, again, went through so many different things and experienced so many different things. I'm wondering where it was that you really saw, because you have an understanding of the power and the impact of the arts and of art, and you communicate that really clearly. When I'm wondering if there was like a moment where it clicked, or was it a conversation, you know, at a Dallas college, or where was it where you were like, all of these things that I'm thinking, whether it's dentistry, whether it's armed forces and, you know, pursuits and living well and later on down the road having a good plan, where did it click of art is the vehicle that I'm going to drive?
Oh, that's funny. I have a horrible memory, but I think I just kind of remember it always being there. So my mom used to work for a bank and had a lot of access to like paper, just like the stacks of paper we still use today in printers. So mm-hmm. she'd bring a stack of paper, 300 sheets of paper back home. She'd buy me the Cracker Jack boxes that had the X-Men or Batman cards in them. My dad didn't have an education at all, and he actually learned how to read through comics. Mm-hmm. And so I would sit down and I would draw that, and I would talk to him, and that was it. And that's all I did from, God, I'm the early 90s mm-hmm. on, and it just kind of stuck there. But there was a time that, like, art wasn't a thing. For a very long time, art mm-hmm. wasn't a thing. But it was honestly all that time my mom and dad spent with me just like, yeah, draw. You know, spend that time. Do what you want to do. Everyone giving me, like, I don't know if you remember those, like, info, like, packets of, like, markers and paints pencils and stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah. And my dad humoring me with conversations of comics that I would make up in my head. And we'd be on drives, and I'd be telling both of them about all of these other things. And, you know, not being dismissive, but like, yeah, that sounds great. That's cool. And going back home into my room and just drawing for hours at a time. Yeah. It really mostly just started there, and it just seemed like a natural progression from there. Mm. Yeah. But it started at that long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I mean, they obviously, they're very valuable experiences to reflect on from the sound of it, but... it's just always, for me, as a fan and as a patron and as an administrator in the field, it's always exciting to see a really deep understanding of the power of what someone does, of what they, you know, commit to working in. And so, you know, we mentioned that we have some people in the building today that they're college students. And so we're always thinking with the programming that we do here as the Cultural Center, what is our goal in terms of how we're aligning to our mission, but the kind of experience that we're presenting for whoever wants to be a part of it. But I think, and I brag about our team here because I think we have a really strong understanding of just how powerful those kinds of memories and those experiences are, because it could be as simple as sliding over a blank sheet of paper to someone and saying, hey, you should draw. Here's some inspiration. And cool, we're going to be supportive and not say, well, no, you need something to fall back on. Or, do you really want to do that? You might want to look into this. So
yeah, yeah. I don't get me wrong. Yes, very much so. My parents were all about, you know, multitude of purposes, but I think they, growing up working with my dad, Texas in the 90s, and cutting grass and doing a lot of other things, and doing that, they were like, you know, you're gonna work. You might as well do something else you like to.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Absolutely. Going back to the process of making these, because when we initially talked, you know, we talked about, you know, some three-dimensional, some sculptural work. And of course, again, it's a beautiful exhibition. So, but I'm thinking about, like, when you're like in the studio and you're in the zone and you're making these, because they are each individually unique. Can you kind of talk to us about, like, I know there's always like some intuitive kind of motions there when you're making art, no matter what you're making, even if it's like, you know, hyperrealism, you're doing a portrait of someone or something, or if you're doing something more abstract. But can you talk about, you know, you're thinking in terms of like the sizes and even like some of the patterns that you've gotten in terms of like the color gradations.
Yeah. I want to get the logistical aspects out of the way. While this is my passion and I want to pursue everything that I can, I first and foremost, okay, what's the budget? Like, how do we work from the budget? And the budget is I'm driving from Colorado to Texas.
Yeah.
Okay. What's my size constraint? Mm-hmm. And so dimensionally, I know I can work really small, but what's my max dimensions?
Yeah.
And then once I have those two kind of limits, left mm-hmm. and right side, then I start working in from there. And the process for me, specifically we're talking about the process, is, okay, I have these colors, these forms, these shapes. I need to think about, okay, that time in Texas when I was playing soccer, or that time when I went to Galveston, or when I went to Fiesta with my tia, or this and that and the other. And it's like, okay, this is representative of that moment. These colors match that opportunity or that moment that I had with those people and that experience. How do I bring those together? And then as I'm making the work, I'm making sure that I'm not making copies.
Got it.
Because when I sit there and what I think about is like, okay, what should it look like? All right, now I need to just make sure I don't make that thing. And then mm-hmm. I just keep going over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. That's a really broad sense of like the process. We can get into the finer details of that, but that's how it kind of starts.
Well, and you, like we said, there's a lot of work. There's like 90 pieces. So I'm interested too. And when you were in the studio making these, were you kind of like, you know, trying to work on one each day or a few, you know, did you have a few kind of in process or were you like, I've got to get this one done and then I'll go to the next one. I'm always really interested in, because I am an artist as well, but in that like when you're in your studio, what is like your practice like and how do you move through your practice day to day?
Well, for this series and for those who don't know my work, I work in 3D. My pinatas at the smallest range go from 3.5 feet to the largest scale, which is 15.5 feet. And those are very abstract self-portraitures. Mm-hmm. And then going to this, the idea is, okay, here's my deadline. I need to work backwards in the timetable from there. How am I going to break up my days? Mm-hmm. I do have other things going on in life.
Yeah.
And honestly, I can give you the exact idea of it. It was on average every single day, I need to produce 3 pieces.
Okay.
Every single day.
Yeah.
Going from there, I had to think about dry time, cut time, measurement time, driving to go pick up every single material or when I'm going to be leaving. And so that what it really boiled down to is like looking at the materials, what I wanted, like here is my best case scenario. Realistically, how many of them can I produce? I try to have loosely a regimented schedule. And I formed a really weird habit of getting up, like we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. super early.
Yeah.
And then just trying to push out as much as I can. Mm-hmm. So I know, like, let's say I am working Monday through Sunday every single day. Mm-hmm. Do I want the weekend off? Okay. I need to produce 6 pieces a day, yes. So I can get the weekend off. Or what if somebody gets sick, whatever the case is. Yeah. So it's always like looking at those numbers, even though this is not a production style. This is like, how is this going to look in the space? I mean, we came the first time and yes. taking photos and everything. And then working backwards from there, just like deciding, mm-hmm. okay, I need to sit down and I need to produce three pieces on average a day for as many days as I can. And then just kind of going from there. Mm-hmm. I do have other numbers and stuff with cutting the work and producing the work and dry times and all this other stuff. But that's really the down and yeah. dirty. Yeah.
I just find it like really smart the way you, you know, strategized and kind of got things down to a science, math and a mathematical kind of equation. And I don't know if that comes from like, you know, having that military background or you know, having that structure and like knowing, okay, or being a teacher and knowing, you know, when you're, you know, laying out a lesson plan or writing your curriculum or any of those things are kind of figuring out what you're going to teach the students each day and when you're going to, you know, have critique and discussion and those kinds of things. But I think it's really important too for artists to hear how other artists work through these things because you're getting ready for a show. It's not like you're just leisurely making, you know, work in your studio. And making art is, I think, is important for everyone to know, not just artists, you know, because we kind of know already. It is a job. Yeah. It's a whole other job. It's a job that you do because you ultimately decide that you do love it, no matter how frustrating it can be sometimes, you know,
yeah.
But you do love it and you can't stop for whatever reason. But it is so much a big part of your life and it does become, something that you do have to work on.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, you know, a kind of, mundane day to day kind of, you know, office job, but it is something you have to work at it. And a lot of people don't realize that about artists. that we're not just, you know, it's not something that we just, you know, went and made it yesterday and we're done. No, you worked, you know, months on this exhibition. And, you know, when people hear this, they're going to understand like the logistics behind all of it, because we've asked you those questions and you've been great enough to provide the answers.
Yeah, I think that one of the big conversations that a lot of people had over the years, I'm not saying this is a new conversation, but we look at Eurocentric artists, right? The romanticized, mm-hmm. you know, somebody passed away, they're living alone on an island, and there's some patron that they have in England that's supporting them.
Yeah.
No, we live in the 21st century now, right? Where the artist is no longer the artist. The artist is the publisher. The artist is the photograph, mm-hmm. the person who takes photographs, who's doing their own press release in certain cases. They're traveling. Mm-hmm. They're the art handler. They're the installer. They're the deinstaller, right? And so now in the contemporary world, the artist, it has to be multifaceted.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying everyone does. They all have a different style. Everyone does different things. But at the end of the day, it's more of like, you've got to do everything, and if you don't, no one else is, you know, no one else is going to pick up the slack for you at the end of the day. Yeah. They're really not going to do it. So the passion has to be there, the drive has to be there, but at the end of the day, you really got to want it, because no one else is going to want it for you more than you should.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to make a comment that's going to be a segue into a little bit of a tangent.
Yeah.
Like, your work, it blurs the line. Even though this show is mostly 2D work, these pieces still blur that line between sculpture and 2D work. And though they are very vibrant and colorful, they're very clean lines. Mm-hmm. And clean lines leads me to talk about cutting, which leads me to talk about your name, Saxon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is a German name
mm-hmm.
that means dagger. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got your name? And maybe it'll give us a little insight into your ethnic background.
That's really funny. My dad might have a different story, but he tells me this story all the time. He's like, yeah, I was like 9. I heard the name. I read about them. And I was like, yeah. So he picked my name out when he was 9 years old. Yeah.
Wow.
He initially heard them.
He knew he was going to have kids.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to catch up. I thought my brain was like, he picked your name when you were 9? How did that work? Sorry.
No, that's fine.
He was nameless.
Yeah. And so the Anglo-Saxons were the stories that he heard from. Not the math, not the a rock band from the 80s, okay. The Anglo-Saxons.
Right, got it.
My parents, both of my parents, grew up here. And during that time, and, you know, even now, it was a really, really rough time. Right? And so a name meant a lot to my dad. A lot of my family, those who might hear it, there's a lot of I'm not going to say it out loud, but my middle name and my last name, there's tons of us with the same exact name. So we go to a family party, somebody calls our name, 16 of us all turn around because we all have the same name. My dad's like, okay, Saxon, that's what I'm going to choose.
Yeah.
And so that's what he ended up picking. Yeah.
Wow.
Or digging his heels into, I think my mom would say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have 5 sisters.
7 sisters.
7 sisters.
Yeah. I'm the youngest.
Yeah.
There's a lot of us. Yeah, I think I'm throwing a lot of names out there because I'm the only reason I'm intentionally throwing names out there for other people is because these people have influenced me a lot. But Brooks Oliver, one of an amazing instructor University of North Texas, ceramicist. Their conversations that we've had tons of times, like talk about the thing about you to a level of specificity that you wouldn't normally talk about. And you'd be surprised how many people can relate to that story mm-hmm. or that experience. Mm-hmm. And so that's like some of the things that I consider. There's a lot of people on this planet and those experiences, while not similar, do float within the same realm. And so it connects us all.
Yeah, I think that's why sometimes you'll see, as an artist, you'll be, you know, I don't know where you'll be, like on the internet or, you know, on social media or wherever, and you'll see someone making art that is not like exactly the thing that you're making or that you want to make, but it has a relationship. And it's sort of like a, that moment, even if they're like, you know, across the globe, there's that like, oh my gosh, someone has some of the same thoughts about the world and perceives things in a similar way, you know. I mean, obviously you don't know for sure, but you see that a work and you just, it's just a really strange feeling. But it really does, I think, emphasize the fact that we are connected in a way that we don't really understand yet as humans. Mm-hmm. And I forget the guy's name. There's a writer that just put out a book and, you know, he's talking about this very thing, that we're all having, we all are connected in some way, and that we are thinking about a lot of the same things in the same ways. And so as an artist, if you're not making the work and putting it out there, someone else is going to do it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you better get your ass in the studio and make that work.
Yeah. I think about those moments, and hearing you say that, I do remember, like, specifically for this style of work, which I'm not coining the phrase beignet motif. I heard it from Justin Favela. If you haven't seen that artist, you definitely should. I remember going to the Denver Art Museum, and their piece that they had there just blew me away, to see the scale and size of that piñata motif style kind of installation. If you haven't seen it, look it up. It's amazing. And then immediately following that, finding my good friend, they're both, I would consider, great friends, Giovanni Valderas here, and then seeing his work specifically on housing and how that came about. It's like, wow, that's great. And the message that they produce is like, specifically with, I would say, in the realm of piñata artists, yes, is like, mm-hmm, there is enough seats at the table for everyone.
Yeah.
And that message is not being shared enough. And they were definitely some of the people. This community, specifically those who focus on piñatas, it's a very, very small community, to the point where if I have a question, I just message them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I get a response back because there's so few of us doing it. And that, like, well, we're sharing the same experience, mm-hmm, and you also have the technical ability to, like, talk to me about it, mm-hmm, is very helpful and produces, like, helps me produce my work, mm-hmm, as well.
That's really cool, because I think being familiar with you, Favi, and Gio, it's like all of that strong, really strong work and relatable, but also, while similar, very different. Mm-hmm. And we had talked about, it was funny, Justin, for Hispanic Heritage Month, he did a performance piece where he did absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I saw that one. And that was really good.
Yeah, yeah, so we talked about it, and we talked about this idea of, you know, we constantly have conversations here about what is it, we're an arts and culture division, right? Mm-hmm. We're the Oak Cliff Cultural Center. We present these experiences. And so we always have, like, these philosophical questions amongst ourselves where we talk about, well, when Hispanic Heritage Month comes around, why do organizations approach and say, hey, we need something for Hispanic Heritage Month. We're coming to you because you're arts and culture, and we need something that just communicates Hispanic heritage. Mm. And so amongst ourselves, we are just saying, what does that mean? And, you know, I made a joke, and I was like, oh, you know, for the reception Saturday, I got to wear my Mexican shirt. And it's like, I just wore whatever shirt I wanted, but I'm Mexican. And so that's what makes shirt Mexican, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it's really cool to one, know that, you know, you have that relationship with these artists. But again, going back to the message of, yes, we work within this kind of realm and or medium, but still with messaging, with style, with impact, every single one of y'all's work is very different. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a really I guess I'll say this now because no one can take it back now. It's a really great place to be, because one of the most frustrating things about being an artist who works specifically with the piñata motif or piñatas themselves is that, as a sculptor, a painter, even a digital artist, if you want to do research, want to watch interviews, if you want to go read a book, You can do that. You can go to any public library or university campus. If you're going to look up paintings and you're going to see Picasso, you're going to get overwhelmed. But as somebody in this field, you're like, well, how do I think about like the piñata and the impacts, the political aspect, the cultural aspect, the communities? What do I do? You get absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And it's extremely frustrating when you're talking about like, well, we need artists in your field and credible research. Like, what do you present? And you're like, I am where the buck stops.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it allows that element of freedom to discover and create and make and become the leading expert, because there are very few of them in it. And that's the exhilarating part of it, is like, people have set the foundation. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. It hasn't existed. Piñata, or the idea of the piñata, has existed for a very, very long time. But to be in this place where, no, like, no one can say that this is something that is can be questioned, because I'm the one doing it in this way. And I like that.
I feel like you must have had some kind of recording device in our office, because you're talking about things that we've been talking about. Just in this week alone, we were talking about...
No, it's because we're connected.
Well, yeah, no, we're connected. You know, we had conversations surrounding, you know, those who have come before us. It sounds like... like talking about a Star Wars movie. who laid these foundations, who did the groundwork on a lot of things. And, you know, a lot of the times it's thank you for what you've done, because now it allows us to go farther and to develop further. You know, there comes kind of back and forth situations where it's like, well, thank you for what you did, but that doesn't make you the authority on where we are now. Because there's so much that needs to be documented, needs to be researched, needs to be explained. And it's like, you know, a lot of the really strong foundational work has to happen before we can go on and develop these kinds of conversations and the research and the, you know, the validity of what a piñata motif represents and things like that.
Yeah, it's a very exciting time. Very much so.
Yeah.
Totally. That's really cool.
So just to give the listeners a little preview of what's to come, you briefly talked about during the install day some things that you're working on in the next body of work. so you don't need to explain everything, but can you tell our listeners like what you're doing now? Because when we talked about it, I mean, it's very technical, and there's a lot of it's very tenuous. Can you tell the listeners what you're working on?
Okay, so for those of you who see this or are able to come out, you'll see the two-dimensional work. The idea behind this for me specifically is, okay, we've seen piñatas in the 3D. We've seen motifs in the 2D. This is a personal pursuit, and it has no requirements necessarily outside of anyone else in universities or communities or businesses or anything. It's like the world is changing. How do I make sure that my practice is something that's interesting, that's contemporary? And for me, this is probably not the right way to say it, but how do I merge technology into this? And I'm not meaning robotics, but how do I imprint on the paper in a way that's new and exciting for myself? And it's also destructive. So the pieces and everything that you see are already completed. The next step is laser engraving tissue paper. It is not that hard to laser engrave. Well, I've been doing it for me, not for anyone else.
Don't try this at home.
Yeah, don't try this at home, or make sure your shop teacher doesn't watching. Or actually, no, listen to all the rules. You sign the syllabus. Make sure you follow the rules. Laser engraving tissue paper. It's exactly what it sounds like. There's a laser that etches in the tissue paper. Once I found that out, I was like, okay, now how do I do it with a fringe? For those of you listening, it's basically a laser that burns microscopic levels of paper off of the tissue paper. Mm-hmm. It's a laser. So with that being said, if the focus is off, if the speed is too fast, the entire piece catches on fire. So to give you an example, my average number right now is for every three pieces that are fully completed, they don't go in sections. They go in all in one piece. That's what works best for me. And hey, if anyone ever hears this and is like, no, you can do it this way, please let me know. the three pieces go in, and on average, I will receive one piece out because the other two will most likely catch on fire. And it's the idea of obstruction, familiarity, and abstraction. And what I mean by that is there are images and places that are important to me, but I don't need people to know, oh, that's Jefferson. That's, you know, right next to Fiesta, or that's next to that Taqueria or something like that. I want to imprint images and ideas of memories that I have into the paper. And because of the fringe and the ability to etch into the paper, I can create this like abstract imagery. And some of it is able to be etched into the cardboard. Some of it's able to etch into the tissue paper. But it is a very time-consuming process that does produce this, what I find very interesting, abstract image. The first series that I produced was about the changing lines and demographics of Oak Cliff over the last 30 years. I created a triptych. And in that, there are cardboard... I would say a cardboard frame, like a traditional picture frame, with mat board that borders it. And in the center is tissue paper fringe. And I laser engrave 1990s, the 1990 outlay of major streets and infrastructure in Oak Cliff. And then the next one was 2000. And then the following one was 2010. And it's to show the transgression or the change and the transformation of the community, but also to talk about like other elements within that where people are being moved from where they live for a lot of different reasons. Right. And so each continuing piece becomes more degraded over time because of how that affects the community and how that shifts and changes housing, resources and access to a lot of different people. And so that's where the initial thing came from. A lot of it came out on cardboard, a lot of it came out of the mat board, and it kind of came out on the tissue paper. And now I'm trying to push that idea even further. In theory, that's that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, if there are any laser experts out there listening, and you have any tips, I mean, I think Saxon's figuring it out in his shop, in his studio. But if you know of any better ways to laser engrave in tissue paper without there being this sort of like only one comes out of for every three pieces and there's fires, small fires.
Yeah. Manageable, manageable, totally safe. NFPA standards are all followed.
Send us an email. We'll get it to Saxon.
Do you journal? Do you take photos of like in process kinds of thing for your own sake?
No, this is a really bad habit, I will say. This is a really, really bad habit, but it's all in my head. I don't write. I don't write any of it down, and it just continuously stays in there. It's like it truly is selective memory. I can't remember what I had last week Tuesday, but I can tell you the power and speed of a certain size of a piece that I want to make.
That's funny.
Yeah,
but fascinating. And I'm glad that we're. I mean, thank you for sharing some of this, because I think, like as an observer or as a consumer of your experiences as an artist, I think that just. It blows my mind to think of what your kind of end piece is, but the process of getting there, like all of that is just so rich with details of what makes what your work represents. Like, I mean, you talk about like the lines of Oak Cliff on laser engraving on paper that is delicate, and how delicate is our community that is being imposed on, right? And so the voyage of getting to that point of commentary is equally as fascinating as an observer. So that's why I ask if, you know, because I think like, man, if everyone, you know, we as an audience, we'll get to see the piece, right? We'll see it on a wall or somewhere. But if there's a way to say, well, you know, it was a journey to get here, and this is how that journey went. Oh, man, that is just like it's exciting times for sure, because my mind is like, really just, you know, kind of enjoying the narrative of all of that you're working through. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, I know. I appreciate it. I appreciate you all asking questions and, you know, inviting me here. This is truly like, this is a monumental occasion for me and for those people who don't know. Like, I grew up here. And 95% of my family is here. Most of my friends are here. I got my master's degree here. Most of my peers are here. Some of my students are here. And so this is like one of the best things that I could have possibly like been able to come to. So yeah, I'm very excited.
Yay. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So good.
I know. I'm just like, more stories, please.
You know, I'm hoping maybe when I come back and I'll have some 3D work, we can talk about that, because that is its own thing. That is definitely still influenced by Oak Cliff as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe someday soon.
Yeah, yes. No, for sure. I think it's always important. One, I mean, obviously, we're doing, you know, tooting our own horn here, but we're doing great work at the Cultural Center. And I think with the gallery reception happening, it's easy enough for us to look forward to something that's going to open tomorrow. But it's also as fun to think of, man, where are we going to be a year from now? Mm-hmm. Where is Saxon going to be a year from now? Where is he going to be 5 years from now? And we were talking about, you had mentioned something about this being like a 6-year kind of labor process in terms of getting this done. The kind of work that happens to make those things possible, it's laborious. A lot of people have to do a lot of work and get support to make things like that happen. So we absolutely follow, and we will absolutely stay tuned. And if at any point in time we can make that conversation happen again, understand that we will do everything we can to make sure that we're in dialogue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I might have some off the record questions. They might not be entertaining for our listening audience.
Yeah, no, that's always fun.
Yeah, I mean, do we have any other questions, or is there anything that you want to share? Anything, you know, in terms of where maybe the public might be able to find you if they have a question or if they're interested in your work?
If you're interested in my work, Saxon Martinez, Saxon Martinez with a Z, not an S. I didn't know that was a thing until recently. If you see a piñata on that image, that's me. And that's pretty much it. That's the only place that I'm at. Please don't look me up on TikTok. I'm struggling with that right now. And now that I'm out of grad school, I have to restart up my website again. So only Instagram right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Saxon Martinez on Instagram.
Yes.
Perfect. Yeah. Cool. Any other questions, OC3 team?
No.
Oh, I will. I do want to end with this, because this is my first time teaching out of grad school. I do apologize for my students who are freezing their butts off in Colorado. I will be back next week, and I apologize for not being there right now. But I am so excited to start this journey here and then get back and continue with that community there as well.
But listen up, students. He's doing this to demonstrate. Y'all, this is professional practice. This is how you do it. So watch and learn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I will say, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I'm not in your classroom. I don't know what that's like. But I think it's safe to say that the students that you have are you know, they're gaining a lot, and they're in a position to gain a lot. So if the students are listening, as someone who's been working in arts administration at a cultural center, this particular one, for 12 years, and working with a team that has been in the field for a really long time, we are excited and thrilled to be able to, you know, work with Saxon and have him provide the types of examples that our community is following. So thank you.
Yeah, yes, thank you all.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right. Well, before I ask other questions that I think will lead us into another hour of conversation, again, thank you to Saxon Martinez, our guest. Not sure when this will be out, but if it is out before Saturday, which I doubt it will be, make sure you join us for the reception of Memoirs, an exhibition by Saxon Martinez, Saturday, January 20th, 2024. The reception is from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Again, you've been listening to OC3 Frequencies, a podcast by the Oak Cliff Cultural Center. We are a division of the City of Dallas Office of Arts and Culture. You can listen to us on Spotify, SoundCloud, and Apple Podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, make sure you give us 5 stars. I think it's 5 stars, right? Is it 4 stars or 5 stars?
It's 5.
Give us as many stars as you can give us, because we appreciate it. We like the support. We always are very appreciative of the support that the community gives us. So if you have any questions, concerns, feedback, ideas, make sure to drop us a line. Go to occ.dallas, occ.dallasculture.org. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Oak Cliff Cultural Center. And on that note, thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you on the next one. Bye,
y'all. See y'all later.
Bye-bye.